Jan Potočka is considered the greatest modern-day Czech philosopher and a major influence on Václav Havel. One person who is an expert on the close ties between the two thinkers is political philosopher Aviazir Tucker, and he is Ian Willoughby's guest in this week's edition of One on One.
Struck as a PhD student by the philosophical language used by Václav Havel in his famous 1990 speech to the US Congress, Aviazir Tucker went on to write The Philosophy and Politics of Czech Dissidents, from Potočka to Havel. More recently, Tucker, whose wife is Czech, has turned his attention to what really happened when communism fell at the end of the 1980s. We discussed his latest book, The Legacies of Totalitarianism, and his call for a new kind of dissident today, when the Israeli-born political philosopher visited our studios recently. But first, I asked him to outline the ideas of Jan Potočka, the great Czech philosopher and Charter 77 spokesman, who died after a lengthy STB interrogation.
He saw the history of humanity, or at least European humanity in the modern era, as a history of alienation from truth. It was very important for him that people should live in truth, not just know the truth, but live in truth. Live in truth meant for him a kind of idealized life in the Greek polis that people constantly argue, have this kind of Socratic dialogues, and you can't do that unless you have human rights. And of course, you didn't have human rights, and you were lost, or modern humanity was lost in kind of production, reproduction, consumerism. As you know, consumerism was the basic ideology of the Czech regime in the 60s and 70s, not so much communist ideology that kind of became discredited in the 50s. The question for him was, how do you break this hold of alienation on humanity? And his answer was through self-sacrifice. Because by confronting finitude, by confronting your own death, if you think about your own death, that's the one act or the one experience of your life that you will experience entirely by yourself. When you think about death and you choose death as or the risk of death, to take the risk of death as self-sacrifice, that breaks this kind of hold of alienation. That's where he thought that he had a double duty here, both to himself and to his nation or to humanity. To himself, self-sacrifice, though it had a political goal, actually had an ulterior motive, which was to obtain authenticity or some kind of a mystical union with the universe. The other goal was a social goal, which was life in truth, to actually practice this kind of life of arguing and debating that allow us to be properly human beings, because human beings are the only animal that has a concept of truth.
Well, you mentioned life in truth, which is something many people would associate with Havel. How much did Potočka's philosophy influence Havel?
It crucially influenced Havel. There's no doubt that many of Havel's ideas in texts like The Power of the Powerless and Politics and Conscience are owe very much to Potočka. What is interesting is that Potočka owes much of his own philosophy to Martin Heidegger. Martin Heidegger, as people know today, was an active Nazi. And it is interesting that Havel neutralizes the negative elements in the philosophy of Heidegger, because for Heidegger, human authenticity was entirely negative. It meant you are not inauthentic, you are not alienated. But what it actually means is something that he left entirely open, and then when he actually made his own choices, the result was fairly ridiculous. Now, what Potočka and Havel took from Plato, which is something that Heidegger didn't, is a concept of a soul, concept of life in truth in a polis, of debate, of human rights.
Havel was frequently referred to as a philosopher king. Was he really a philosopher? I know he used philosophical language, but is it right to consider Havel a philosopher?
I think so, yes. Because the concept of a philosopher in the West, or what we used to call the West, was that of an academic. Havel definitely was not an academic. Havel's books don't have footnotes. Havel was not updated to the latest debates about political philosophy in Harvard or Yale. Havel did know the environment, the political environment where he existed, much better than any of the political theorists in the West who didn't experience what it's like to actually live in late totalitarianism, in a period that did not have the gulags and the mass murder, but attempted to control people by using carrots and sticks, consumerist carrots and sticks, by making them lose their jobs, their houses, education for their children, but not lose their life. He understood the tendency of people to become alienated from themselves, to lie to themselves in order to become part of this system. And in that respect, I think his contribution to political theory, to understanding late totalitarianism, is pivotal, and it's much more important than the works of people who read and wrote many more books with many more footnotes. What he understood was the environment where he was, and then he used conceptual tools from phenomenology, from Patochka, from Plato and other philosophers to try and understand that environment and write in a popular style so it would be accessible not just to academics. And I think in that respect, he is a much better philosopher than philosophers who just write for other philosophers.
And how did his philosophy prepare him for the reality of post-communism? Was he equipped to deal with it?
Well, that's a bit more embarrassing. Havel's theory, while he was a dissident, was that you build the proper house of humanity or the proper political house by making good bricks. So if people are virtuous and authentic and moral, they will create a great state. Now, they can't create a great state because they're prevented from it. So in the meanwhile, what we could do is that create these great people, create a good community. Then there will be what he called an existential revolution, and then everything will be great. That's not how history turned out. Now, his conception of democratic policy is not that different from that of, let's say, Thomas Jefferson, who also believed that you have to build a great republic by having great people, great citizens. But the opposite concept, the concept that underlies the American Constitution, is that people are not virtuous and they're not going to be virtuous. They are corrupt. They always will be corrupt. What you need to do then is construct institutions that will transform the greed, the power-hungry, the narcissistic, even to refer to contemporary politics, of people into political virtue. And you do that by creating a balance of power between those institutions. Havel was entirely unprepared to construct institutions because, as a dissident, he never had any experience of constructing institutions, of managing anything more than a samizdat publishing house. And when the time came, he didn't know how to construct institutions that would neutralize the legacies of totalitarianism that still exist in the minds of people long after the regime is dead.
Last year you published The Legacies of Totalitarianism, and I was reading that you posit that what happened in the late period of communism was that the elite kind of adapted and continued to be the elite after the fall of communism.
Yes, very much so. I believe that there's much more continuity after 1989 than most people believe. There's much more continuity in the composition of the elites, much more continuity in the inertia of institutions, and even in the minds of people, in the way that people think and analyze. Even though the regime is gone, its legacies are affecting everyday life. My theory is that if you want to understand what happened in 1989, the best way to look at it is at the interests of the most dynamic group. And the most dynamic group, the group that had the power to make changes, was not that of the dissidents. It was of the late communist nomenklatura. Democracy, in that respect, was a side effect or unintended consequence of what I call the adjustments of their rights to their interests. That is, the second generation communist elite inherited from the revolutionary generation, the people who created communism, a set of rights. They could force people not to immigrate. They could force people not to express themselves. They could force people to march on May Day demonstrations. They didn't inherit a group of rights that were of much interest to them, namely property rights. Mostly they could not bequest whatever wealth they created for themselves to their children, because there were no property rights. And their interest was to transform the kind of liberties that they had into property rights proper. That is, imagine that you are squatting in a house. You can enjoy the house, you can do a lot of nice things for yourself, but you have no certainty the next week you will still be able to live there because somebody could take it away from you. The communist elite privileges were very much like that of squatters. They could enjoy them while they lasted, but at any time there could be some sort of a political shake-up and they could find themselves out of a job or out of without any of the privileges to which they became accustomed. And most importantly, it was very difficult for them to bequest those privileges to their children. Unlike the revolutionary generation, they had families, they had normal families, and they cared for them. It was very important for them to create those conditions. that need to be distinguished from capitalism, from free market. They had no interest in capitalism or in free market. They had interest in property rights, in privileges, not in opening the market for competition. So when the time came, when the force of the regime weakened, when they stopped enforcing the rules of the regime on each other, because there was nobody else to force it on them, they forced it on each other, they simply established property rights where previously they simply had squatting rights, and then the whole edifice of communism collapsed.
And I guess it flows from what you're saying that the people who were on the wrong side pre-89 continue to be on the wrong side, to be the kind of losers post-1989.
Well, many of them did. We can distinguish two groups of countries. One group of countries, like the Visegrad countries, Czech Republic, Slovakia, Hungary, Poland, the Baltic countries, had a replacement of elites in politics, in the media, and sometimes new elites emerged when they worked for foreign companies or in small businesses. In other countries, Russia, Belarus, Ukraine, and so on, there was a continuity of the elites. That is, whoever was running the country in 1989 or 1991 continued to run it afterwards. Just the front row leaders moved to the country houses, but then it is exactly the same elite. I argue that as long as there's no change of elites, at least in politics and the media, we cannot talk about post-totalitarianism. It is still a late totalitarian period, even if there is geopolitical realignment, even if people can leave the country, even if the immigration and emigration are free. What you will find is that in countries like Romania, post-totalitarianism actually emerged only about 10 years after the so-called revolution of 1989, when there was, for the first time, a change in the political elite. In countries like Russia, it's interesting that it went through a cycle. That is, in the 1990s, it looked like there was some change in the elites, and then there was a restoration, pretty much like you would see, let's say, a restoration in France in 1815 after the Napoleonic Wars. The same elites just come back and recapture power. So there was this kind of cycle. The false assumption of the 1990s, of many political theories in the 1990s, that there was this kind of ineluctable process with a teleology, with a purpose, that we were all going to be liberal democrats with the rule of law. It may take longer, it may take shorter, there may be birth pang, but that's where we are going. That was a mistake. Most countries that were not democratic in 1989 are not democratic today. There's only a small minority of countries that became democratic. Even there, democracy, as we can see today, is pretty fragile.
And you believe that today there is a need for a new kind of dissident?
Yes, I believe that especially today, when we have this kind of dichotomy between corrupt elites and populistic xenophobia, that's exactly the time when we need the dissidents to come back and tell truth to power, which was the original function of dissidents. We need people who would be able to tell the populist that their protests against the elite is correct, but xenophobia is really not the answer. They need to tell the elite that their role is not to steal but to manage, and to offer a third alternative between those two horrible choices of the existing elites and the populists. We can see in countries like Hungary and Poland, where the revolt against the elites, in my opinion, was completely justified. Replacing the old communist judges is long overdue, if anything. The problem is that they're not replacing them with new, multiple, heterogeneous, democratic elites. They're just replacing them with other totalitarian elites that are loyal to a single party. So we haven't really advanced much. We just changed one group of crooks for another group of crooks. It's time to have a pluralistic society with competing elites, which underlie democracy.
And from everything you're saying, I'm not getting the feeling that you're optimistic for this part of the world.
Well, if there's one thing we learned from history, you never know. There was not much reason to be optimistic in 1988, and in 1 year, things changed very quickly. That's the significance of dissidents. You need, and the significance of opposition in any democratic regime, that you need people who are ready to take the opportunity, if and when the opportunity comes. And you never know, because populism always fails. There's not a single case in human history when populism was successful. So if it's going to be tried, it will fail, and then there has to be another alternative. Not another populist regime, not a military coup, obviously. There has to be a group of elite members who are intellectually ready to take power and have plans and can state those plans clearly and in a way that people can understand.